When your aircraft is new or restored, that may be when it needs the pre-flight most of all. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. Today we're going to take on a safety issue that doesn't seem to bite people too often, but boy, when it does, it's a big one, and that is some of the things that can be wrong with an aircraft that has recently come out of any kind of maintenance, especially if we're casual, overly casual about a pre-flight. Bob, thanks for taking some time out to talk to our listeners today.
Well, I enjoy being with you, Paul.
Let's talk about the accident that actually prompted this article, and that was something that happened with a plane which had just been worked on.
Well, you know, whenever we are out and about flying and we get in our airplane and we've been flying that airplane every day, we know our airplane, we tend to be somewhat casual, perhaps, on doing the pre-flight. I know that when we take an en-route stop with a student, we'll go out for a hamburger or something cold to drink and come back in, and the student will always ask me at that point, we've been away from the airplane for an hour. Do we need to do a complete and exhaustive pre-flight check, keeping in mind we just did this earlier today? And my answer is always no, of course not. When we get back in, we want to check to see that it hasn't been disturbed, it hasn't been bumped. We'll certainly always check the oil, but we don't have to do that complete exhaustive check when we're making that en-route stop. However, when an airplane comes out of maintenance, or when an airplane, certainly in the case that I refer to in this article, is coming out of a restoration process, we cannot be at all casual about that pre-flight inspection. An airplane coming out of maintenance is something that has been tampered with, hopefully by a professional who knows exactly what they're doing. But in some cases, those professionals may use a helper, they may be using an apprentice, they may be in a hurry, they may have overlooked something that if we do not check it prior to our departure, particularly that first flight, it can come back and bite us as it did in this case.
Okay, now in this particular case, what I was going to say is with the growing percentage of the general aviation piston fleet that is made up of experimentals, obviously, there are going to be people who are not AMPs working on these things, but that doesn't really explain anything here. This is a Piper PA-12, and it had undergone an extensive restoration. But you talked about something interesting. We roll the control yoke or stick to the left or the right, and we watch for movement. But do we make the conscious connection at the level of, now, wait a minute, is it going in the right direction?
You know, that's right. And we teach a technique, and lots of old flight instructors have taught this technique, and one I like, just with your left hand, put your hand on the stick or on the side of the yoke and stick your thumb straight upward. And then roll that stick or yoke to the left. That upward thumb will point to an upward aileron. Roll that stick to the right or that yoke, roll it over to the right, and your thumb will point to the right, and that aileron better be going up. In this particular PA-12, as unimaginable as it might seem, the owner had taken it through an extensive restoration process, was satisfied that it was airworthy, got in the airplane, took off, and lo and behold, after the accident, fatal accident, they discovered that the elevator cables had been reversed, and that up was down and down was up, and it doesn't take a great deal of imagination to figure out what happened shortly after takeoff, and it did with fatal results.
Well, and elevators, if you think about the rigging of, especially if it's done with cables, the rigging of a control stick, when you push the stick forward, the elevator has to go down. And that will often require or be part of a design in which the cables are intentionally crossed on their way back. And so I guess what must happen is some mechanics, especially if you're restoring a plane of which there aren't a whole lot around and you don't see this often, may look at the cable path as being most intuitively and visually correct when it's not crossed.
Yeah, I mean, we're human. There's no question that this was a gross error on somebody's part, but the error is one thing. The failure to check that error is quite another. And again, coming out of a restoration process, even when an airplane comes out of an oil change, When it comes out of an oil change, you know, after the airplane has been returned, I mean, we put the oil in, we put the mechanic puts the drain plug back in, tightens it all down. What do? We run it up. We leak check it. We want to be sure that there is no untoward leaks or unexpected leaks even after the run up. Whenever an airplane comes out of annual, particularly when inspection plates have been opened up and we've gotten up inside, may have lubricated or may have done some work on some hinges or on some cables, this is a time that it's just in our own best interest to go through that very, very carefully. I have a friend of mine had some work done on a gear recently, and the final reassembly of that gear mechanism was not done properly, and he nearly lost his life as a result of a faulty nose gear operation shortly after takeoff. Could he have found that had he gone under there and inspected it himself? Perhaps not. You know, we are pilots. We entrust our mechanical servicing to licensed professionals to do that, but they too are human. You know, my good friend Jim Cavanaugh, I've always commented upon his pre-flight experiences. Every time he gets in an airplane, he pre-flights it like he's going to buy it. You know, and I say, come on, Jim, let's get going. And he's careful to a T, careful to a fault. But I know for a fact that Jim saved his own life because just moments before takeoff, he made one last glance at his oil pressure gauge on a Cessna 150 and noticed that there was no oil pressure and shut it down immediately prior to advancing full power to takeoff. What he had discovered was that the oil pump had failed someplace between startup and takeoff. And had he not checked that, he likely would have been a serious casualty. So, you know, we're all in a hurry. We're all somewhat impatient. We all believe we know our airplanes. But there's never a reason to, you know, skip over some of these important things. Lastly, let me just say I remember at a neighboring flight school where one of my students reported to me that the instructor at that neighboring flight school said that he did not have to bother pre-flighting this particular airplane because it was a brand new one. Brand new model just arrived in the fleet. Fortunately, that flight school discharged that flight instructor never to come back again. You know, that kind of short-sighted teaching is something that can get us all into a lot of trouble. These are mechanical devices. They need to be checked.
Well, and in the case of this PA-12 that formed the basis of your article, as you pointed out, when asked about the failure to do a high-speed taxi check prior to getting the sign-off, the pilot was reported to have said, "I've done this numerous times and it hasn't killed me yet." And obviously, on the next time it did.
Well, yeah, and that's a case where we talked a while back about overconfidence. You know, he's done this many times. It hasn't bitten him in the past, and that's right. Sometimes that overconfidence gets us, and whether it's flying or in pre-flight checks, the airplanes are inherently safe. But as the poster says, they're very, very intolerant of any incapacity, oversight, or neglect. We have to be careful when we work around these things.
Well, and it's a natural tendency psychologically in any phase of our lives to start to disregard the dangers of something we've done without incident in the past. That doesn't necessarily mean we have done it safely.
That's right. That's exactly right, Paul.
Bob, when we come back from the break, let's talk briefly about a couple of changes recently at Bob Miller Flight Training. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Freedom through control. Cirrus has completely reinvented the personal aircraft and the entire experience of owning a personal aircraft. It's a bold new take on private aviation that we call Cirrus Flying 2.0. You set the schedule. You chart the course. You're in control.
Piperjet.
Hypersport.
Piper Match.
Global Expansion.
Meridian, Mirage, Matrix, and more.
With so much happening at Piper, how can I possibly keep up?
Get informed. Get involved at facebook.com/Piper Aircraft.
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. And we didn't want to get out of this one, Bob, without talking about a few things that have changed recently, how things are going at Bob Miller Flight Training. One of them is, we talked already about your second location in Genesee County over at Batavia, which is a shorter flight than it is a drive from Lancaster. But you also got some new digs at the Lancaster Airport. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the reasons I took a five-month hiatus from Over the Airwaves is the fact that we were extremely fortunate going into the first 6 months of the year 2010, having grown very, very rapidly. We were doing lots of things that we believed needed to be done in a difficult economy to maintain our competitive position, and fortunately, most of them were working. And what we rapidly did was outgrow our modest facilities, which were designed to be temporary at best anyway. But we found ourselves with four flight instructors trying to all work out of a single office, and that simply was not going to work. And push came to shove, and we had to move on very, very short order. We were creating a kind of a logistical problem for our host at the airport, because we were using community facilities for our own flight school activities. So we bit the bullet and moved to the other side of the airport. Now we have large, much more spacious facilities. We have an electronic classroom. We have adequate room for all of our flight instructors. We have, kitchen facilities. We have waiting room facilities. It just was something that we needed to do.
Okay, now one of the things that's different about the building, too, that you're in now is that it better accommodates your attempt to do some of your work online. I know you're not too far into this yet, but tell us how you have found the process of trying to conduct training online with your webinars.
Well, we've started a whole new division of the company. It's just simply called Bob Miller Flight Training Online. And we're responding to my good friend Sue Wunderling down in Broken Straw, New York, or Broken Straw, Pennsylvania. She had been after us and her friends down there to make available our on-site training, make it available online, because it was just a two-hour drive up here for a weekly session was just untenable. And she felt, and others have felt, that what we were teaching on in the classroom could easily be replicated around the world. So we're going out now with our first 8-week program. It's a ground school private pilot ground refresher course going out on the webinar. It started in late October, and it will continue right through the end of this year. And we hope to continue a whole series. The next series will be in a ground instrument course, and then we'll get into some specialty courses. We'll put them online, put a notification on Over the Airwaves, and we'll also have a schedule of upcoming courses on our website, bobmillerflighttraining.com. And we hope that our Over the Airwaves listeners and readers, we certainly hope that your readers here over at AeroNewsNet will take advantage of that and sign up for some of these courses.
Okay, let's mention quickly here, too, Aviation Explorer Post 162. First of all, that's cute that it's named the same as a skycatcher, but what is involved in an aviation explorer post? And talk, if you would, for a minute about this specifically from the standpoint of someone who might be concerned about the additional liability or just hassles in general that he might be taking on to do this with his flight school.
Well, we've long recognized that the future of aviation, as most of us do, know that those that are in middle school and high school today are the next generation of aviation people, and we've got to do our best to attract these individuals into the program. I've worked closely with our local EAA chapter over the years, and they have a wonderful program, as you know, EAA nationally or internationally does, called Young Eagles. And that's a great way to expose young people to a first flight. One of the difficulties, though, that I've seen or observed with the Young Eagles program is we may get a youngster all fired up and enthused about that first flight that he or she has taken, but we need to have a strong follow-up program, a weekly program that individual can be, their interest can be reinforced and supported and enhanced. Local Civil Air Patrol programs have come a long way in making that happen, but we wanted to add our own thrust to this by creating and working with, I should say, the local Boy Scout Council in creating this Explorer Post program to attract youngsters between ages 13 and 19. And let me say that one of the unique aspects of this program, Paul, unlike Civil Air Patrol and unlike Young Eagles, and unlike scouting in many cases, we do as much as we can to attract a parent participant with each youngster that we serve in the program so that we can have a parent-child or parent-adolescent working side-by-side through the activities that we're doing so that we can build a stronger bond between a parent and that child, and they have something in common, something that they can relate to, rather than just a place for a parent to drop a child off for an activity one night a week.
Well, Bob, that sounds like a great way not only to get more young people involved, but also kind of spread the good news side of general aviation in a community where, I mean, given recent events, looking back over the past couple of years, may need some work with the adults as well.
Well, adults are, you know, they're the strongest reinforcers that children have. And when we can get a parent to share their enthusiasm for aviation, parents have the wherewithal to help kids through with college expenses, to transport them to and from. And, man, we've had more interest from, in many cases, from the dads and moms than we've had from the kids themselves. We took a trip over to the Buffalo Control Tower very recently, and the parents got as much out of that as the kids do, as the kids did. So it's a great way, as I said before, to build that bond, and it's good public relations for the community as well. We wanted to do, in closing, let me just say this, we wanted to do something other than just provide a drop-off point for kids on a Monday night. We want to get those parents involved. We want them to see what these kids are doing. We want to see if we can even get the parents involved. This is a great way to boost aviation, and I can only hope that if flight schools across the country could do something similar, we could really do something to step up the number of new people coming into this business.
Well, Bob, we hope it accomplishes just that, and we plan to check in and see how it's going from time to time. We'll look forward to talking to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
You can always find the latest edition of Bob Miller's newsletter, as well as the archives, at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.